Hello, people. Welcome to another session of Simon Says. And again, hopefully I don't say too much, but I listen a lot to our super superb guests. What about this man? Probably comedy royalty is the best way to put it. From the days of Punter the Punter to the AFL footy show to Hey Hey at Saturday to his love of North Melbourne Football Club, would you welcome the great and wonderful Trevor Marmalade? Trevor, hello, how are you?
Hey, Simon, good to be here. You're looking well, mate.
No, thank you very much for your time. Really appreciate that. And along with us today is I don't know if I'd say royalty yet, but maybe he's not a king yet, but he's a prince. He's been around long enough to get a little bit of coverage. From 3OW sports commentator, head of Nine Radio in the summer of cricket. From his days from the Herald Sun right through Truth, Inside Footy Pump, he's been through all the levels of media and sport. So welcome, Bruce Eaver. How are you?
Yeah, g'day, Simon. Good evening. Hello, everyone. Trev, good to see you as well. This is a role reversal. You chatting to us, Simon. I reckon I've interviewed you about 25 times over the years.
No, and look, I've actually been enjoying this. This is, I think, about our 12th month, and it's been really enlightening and insightful for me because, yeah, you get interviewed, and to interview other people and find out their past and their background has been fantastic. So I'll start with you, Trevor. Now, right back, if I've got it right, I mean, I'd love to know where you started your real interest in comedy, but as far as the public eye sees, Punter to Punter in the 80s is where you started. Is that right?
Yeah, pretty much. I started doing stand-up when I was 19, and I just got up at a comedy club and I didn't think I was trying out. I just thought, I'll just get up and do this once for a bit of a lark. And I got booked, out of my debut spot. And I mean, I wasn't great. I mean, it sort of got laughs, where I thought it would get laughs. But I mean, the fact that I was 19 and I was up there getting laughs and sort of holding the crowd, the management at the club at the Last Laugh there sort of went, okay, yeah, we'll give you a spin. And I got booked straight away.
So you were actually became a regular at the Last Laugh from your first gig?
From my first gig. So to be honest, I was a comedian and I had no idea what a comedian did or how to be one, except I already was one. So
that's a great start.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I had no idea you could even be a comedian in Australia, right? I mean, all my exposure to comedy, growing up were, English and American comedians. I didn't even know there was even a comedy scene in Australia at all. So I got booked out of my first gig and, I did my first gig and the manager of the Last Laugh came up. Alan Pentler was comparing the shows. He was booking the acts. He said, "How old are you?" I said, 19. He said, "How long have you been doing stand-up?" And I went, 12 minutes.
Yeah, what time is it now?
Right. And he went, "Oh, wow." He said, mate, I'd like to book you to do a spot in the late show on Friday night. We'll pay you $25. And not knowing anything, I said, okay, that's only 2 days away. I'm not sure I could write a new routine in 2 days. And he went, "What?" He said, "No, just get up and do what you did tonight." I went, "Oh, really? Oh, okay."
And what did I do? Yeah.
So I did. But the Last Laugh had just opened. And I was pretty lucky for me in that, they'd been sort of running ads in the paper going, comedians wanted to play with a joke. But they had a soft opening in that they weren't having their press night for about a month or so after the opening. And they wanted to have someone young and new on the bill. So basically they just I worked every night leading up to the big press night. Be that guy who'd walked in off the street.
I was going to say so much for the really hard struggle to make it, mate. They just walked straight in. Bruce, while we're talking about starts, you've been a media person for so long now, it's like it's in your blood. How did you start? Did you just get asked to write a story and there it went?
No. Well, it's I worked out pretty early that I wasn't going to be able to play sport at the highest level, but I was obsessed with sport and was lucky enough to go to Halebury College and the late.
And they like this sport.
Yeah, absolutely. And played sport all year round, but knew I wasn't going to be good enough to play at the highest level, not by a long shot. So I wanted to be involved though, and probably the turning point. I lived opposite a sun photographer, Craig Borrow, who is a really good. So I thought for a while I might have a crack at being a photographer. That was like year 9, year 10. I couldn't take a photo of a wall, let alone anything half reasonable. And the late, great Stephen Phillips, who was an old boy of Halebury, he came out in year 11, so 1984, and gave a talk, a lunchtime talk, of a typical Sunday at World of Sport. And it was hilarious. Obviously, the madness that used to be the 3 hours on a Sunday morning into Sunday afternoon. And I walked away from that thinking, I was always told I had the gift of the gab, so I've got to get into the media. I applied everywhere. Cut a long story short, I was lucky enough to get a cadetship on the Herald, before the Herald and the Sun had actually merged. So my first day on the Herald, I didn't even go to uni, straight out of HSC at the end of 85. I started on the Herald. My first day on the Herald as a copy boy, which was like a glorified messenger for the first year of your cadetship, was the day the first space shuttle blew up, late January 1986. So it was a massive news day for the Herald, given it happened at about 4 in the morning our time. And I've never known anything else. I've never worked anywhere but in the media since leaving school.
Oh, that's fantastic. So straight into it. And again, they said the timing of it for Australia is magnificent that way. And now Trevor, I'm going to jump forward, but I want to go back with both of you too. Now, I haven't been able to research this, but I just want to know from your point, at some stage, somebody was saying to me that you were called the comedy doctor because you'd been around so long that there were young blokes who were going, Trevor, I'm not doing well. Could you stand at the back, have a look at my performance and see if you can help me? Now, is that true?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, but look, it was a different type of thing, though, Simon. I mean, yeah, it sounds all very,
Sounds good. Sounds very impressive. Like
I'm a top bloke. But the reality was that, comedy was a pretty small industry, and there was about sort of 30 comics that used to work regularly around the scene that I used to work with. And of course, and then we used to hang out after the show. Like you always, you'd stay around for a few drinks or you'd go back to someone's place. And we just used to talk about what we did. And as a group, you'd sit around going, oh, by the way, that bit you do doesn't go as well anymore. And they go, yeah, you changed it. You used to say that like this. And now you say it like this, you've spoiled the premise.
Yeah.
And we talk about it. And basically it was just really organic like that in that, if I was standing up the back of the room watching another comic do their act and I thought of a joke or I thought they were going to do a joke and it sort of went another way, then I always go, oh, by the way, that bit you do, you should say this.
Yeah.
Should chuck that in, right? Because, well, the thing is, it's boring if we all get up there and talk about the same topics, right? I could be watching that comedian going, oh, he didn't do that joke, I'll do it. But you go, oh no. You don't want everyone talking about all the same things.
Yeah.
So, I'd say, you should chuck that in. And the thing is that, it's such an easy thing to do, but when you're a professional comedian, if someone gives you a joke that stays in your act for years, then you're actually putting food on the table.
Yeah.
Right? So there was a great bunch of us used to always hang around and we'd talk about our stuff and finished up, as people sort of got TV gigs, was kind of like Goodfellas for me. I mean, basically everyone that started after me got on TV before I did, but it was kind of like, but when Joey gets made, it's like we all get made, right? So, yeah. So I wasn't on TV, but I got lots of gigs writing for my friends who were. So, a lot of the shows that they did at the time, we'd sit around all night, watching sport and having a few laughs. And after you do that, with a bunch of people for a long time, all these ideas start to mount up. And one day someone would go, hey, I said, we should write some of this stuff down and do a show. That's kind of how those shows started. And, my friends of mine did those shows. If I wasn't in it, they'd ring me up and say, oh, come and direct it. And now that's kind of, we used to perpetuate the work for each other and help each other out. Because
that's fantastic.
It's a brotherhood,
Yeah, fantastic. And Bruce, just talking about writing, because I know, Trevor, you've got a whole plethora of credits for writing behind the scenes, of course. But Bruce, you talk about the media, you have to, whether it's actually writing it down, but you've got to be creative and come up with writing right from the start.
Yeah, well, I mean, you've got to start with an idea and then you've got to get it down on paper. I mean, even though I've been full-time in radio now for probably the last 16 or 17 years, all the background was in print journalism, and that's the essence of it, an idea and then turning it into a story. But it's interesting, my early stuff on the Herald actually had a bit of a I'm not sure whether Trev can remember this, but I've been in sport since March 88. So I'd had a couple of years on the Herald, and you had to be moved around the different departments as you know, doing your apprenticeship or cadetship as it was. And my final few months before I started on sport was actually on police rounds. So covered the Queen Street massacre in December 1987. I think we've only just gone past the anniversary a couple of days ago, which is a 19-year-old first-year cadet's a big wake-up call. Before that, had some time on features. But in my first year, you just want to get your name in the paper. You just want to see your name. You know, going home on the train and seeing someone reading the Herald and reading a story with your name on it, you almost felt like elbowing them, saying, yeah, that's actually me, you know. So my first few stories, did a couple of pub reviews back in the days just to get in, you know, little eight-part things on, I reckon, the Keysborough Hotel and the Boundary Hotel down in East Bentley were the first two I did. But as Trev will say, that's around the mid-'80s is when comedy started booming.
Yeah.
And I can't even remember how I met him, but I remember after, it was probably my third story ever in the Herald, was an interview with Russell Gilbert. And a great friend of all of ours who hasn't enjoyed the best of health, as we know, in recent years. And then from that, did a couple of stories on him. And then there was a great show. I can never forget, I hope Trev remembers it, the Bizarre Laugh Triangle. And it was Russell Gilbert, Trevor Marmalade, and Glenn Robbins. How's that for a lineup?
Well, that's not a bad lineup, is it? Yeah. That's fantastic.
The Dick Whittington Tavern in St Kilda. It was $25, which got you a two or maybe even a three-course meal and the show. How's that for value? And I remember doing a couple of reviews on that. Trev, I probably had the least to do with you of the three of you, but it was a sensational show. You can imagine with three, you know, comedy gold from these guys. And that was probably, I don't know, in the first 10 stories I ever wrote in the Herald were stories about these guys as the comedy industry started booming.
Well, mate, I was going to say that. Yeah, go on, Trev. That's fantastic.
Yeah, no, it was fun memories of that show. It was a great fun show to do. But that was the thing, is that comedy started to boom because there was no TV to do. Like, you know, we didn't even think that we'd ever be on TV or radio, or mainstream radio, put it that way. So comedy, like, you know, the ambition for any comedian was like to be good enough to do closing spot.
Yeah.
Okay, that was really it. And, you know, and we worked on our art. We didn't really consider that it was going anywhere other than to perform live. But in doing so, like, there was a core of, you know, as I say, 25, 30 comedians back then who worked on their art for 10 years. So when the opportunity came to go on TV, they were actually really good comedians. And not only that, but had a drawer full of material that they could, you know, that they could use, that had been tried and tested on audiences. Yeah. So when the comedy company started and the big gig, and fast forward, you know, people had, you know, I mean, Kath and Kim, like, you know, the girls used to do that on stage in you know, 1984, right? So these characters, like, they're developed, right? Yeah. They're not just guessing. They're actually fully rounded. And they know when they're writing how those characters would react in any situation. So, yeah. I'll tell you a story about that show, Bruce, is that we did like about 6 months run in the finish at the Dick Whittington Tavern, and we finished up doing another version downstairs at the Last Laugh, and a guy turned up who was a producer from Second City. And the Canadian comedy show, which spawned, you know, all, you know, John Candy, you know, many Rick Moranis, like many, many greats. And he was really impressed with the show. He said, oh, do you mind if I tape it? And we sort of went, oh, okay, this is a big shot producer. So, yeah, this could go somewhere. Anyway, he taped it, and, you know, I don't think we ever saw him again after that. But a year later, I was actually in LA, and they had the Second City Club in Santa Monica. And I went there with another Halo Breed boy, Steve Marshall. We were actually So we were tripping around the States together. I said, oh, no, we've got to go to the Second City Club. I'd love to go. And we stood there. We sat there and watched the show. And at the end of it, Steve turned to me and said, wow, there were some really similar bits in that show to yours. And I was going, yes, because I'm sitting there going, I don't want to be like some sort of egomaniac saying, these guys have ripped me off. But that, like,
it was yours.
So many bits of the show were obviously derivative. Put it that
very
way.
Good. Derivative is very, very so, nice way of putting it, mate. Derivative.
I've always wondered about, I mean, plagiarism, you know, in the media, it's you know, almost the greatest taboo. And I'd imagine in, you know, we're all sort of in the same melting pot in the entertainment sort of industry. I imagine plagiarism in the comedy world is rife.
Well, people think that. I mean, that was the great thing about the scene back in those days in the 80s, because we all worked together. We all knew each other's routines inside out. Yeah. And there was, you know, there was a code of honour. You know, you did not do that, right? So, you know, we were original comedians, and we, you know, took pride in being original comedians and writing our own stuff. Because at the end of the day, you know, this is what I tell young comedians when they ask me. I say, you've got something that nobody else has got. And they look at you like, what are you talking about? I said, you have your story, you have your voice, you have your own independent, you know, view of the world. You have your background that nobody else has. You know, find that. Talk about that, you know. And, you know, that's how you become a comedian. Like, you know, people go, oh, who are your influences? Well, nobody, right? And for all comedians, like, you know, yeah, sure, there's stuff we watch that we think's funny, but the thing is not to be influenced by it, is to do your own thing.
I was going to say that's really important, because I've always said, and this is why I think, you know, comedians taking the mickey out of politicians, all that's really important, because to me, comedy is an intelligence, because you take something here that's not funny, you take something over here that's not funny, and you put them together and it's hilarious. And that's almost an intelligence, because there's people who can't do that. They can't see past what's in front of them and can't see, you know, the obtuse or the strange or the angle to actually bring it together.
Well, that's right. I mean, yeah, and it's a convergence of ideas. But and just to illustrate the point about how there was a code of honour amongst the comedians in Melbourne, is there's a story which many of the locals will remember well, in that someone actually broke that code one night. We were all at the Dick Whittington, and there was a whole bunch of us standing at the back of the room, some who'd been on the bill, some who'd just dropped in for a drink. And a guy got up and, was plagiarising material left, right and centre from the people standing in the audience. Right? And I was hosting the show, and I got up and I back announced him as Melbourne's greatest cover comedian. And people still talk about that day. Right, yeah, people like coming through. Oh, I remember that, and like, because everyone fell about the place, and the guy got the message. Right, yeah, right. He never did that again.
No, that's good.
So,
I'll go to both. Yeah, but Bruce, like, it's really interesting, and because Trevor, you talk about not much comedy then, and now how it's grown. For you, Bruce, the change of, like, we're doing a podcast, so the opportunity for anybody in any household to be able to produce something is interesting, but you in the mainstream media, how has it changed in your time? And you had a lot of experience from from the old days of the truth, which was the pink paper with all the sport in it, right through to now, and I had a couple of other pictures in it too. And now you've got so much mainstream media as well as social media. And how's that for you?
Yeah, it's a saturated market, Simon. There's no doubt about that. Just on the truth, I was only there when it was Truth Sport. When it was Truth Sport,
okay, good. Split,
there was a salacious, salacious magazine called The World, which was separate to it. And I went there in the middle of 1994 when Mark Day, just before he went under, actually, financially that is, he still owned it. And within 2 months, I was the news editor, because a guy called Spiros Stamoulis, who was probably more famous for owning Gold Medal Soft Tricks, bought the paper when it was, you know, basically bankrupt. And I left there. I was only there for a bit over 18 months, joined Inside Footy in early 96. But yes, I did work at Truth Sport just behind the old Festival Hall, which has just been bought by the Hillsong Group, actually, hasn't it?
Yes.
And it used to actually be quite funny. I know I'm digressing.
No, please.
Very talented journalist by the name of Brett DeHoot, who's done a fair bit of radio stuff as well. And on this magazine, The World, it wasn't all about, say that. There was
some we can blank it out later, as they say. Yeah.
That's okay. Yeah. We're not live, are we? We are going to be edited. And I reckon his best ever interview, which we used to listen into, he rang. It was when Jeff Kennett was just going berserk in terms of changing Victoria, a lot of it for the good. And he was trying to bring every event here. I think it had just been announced that that we pinched the Grand Prix from Adelaide. And he rang the Egyptian ambassador in Canberra, Brett De Hoop, and he wanted to get his official comments on what he thought of the push by Victoria to lease one of the pyramids for a period of 12 to 24 months. And one of the pyramids would be dismantled and shipped out to Australia and rebuilt on the banks of the Yarra. And the fact is that he did it as a straight interview is one of the funniest things I've ever heard in my life. But they're the sort of days that we're enjoying back in the truth days. But
the trouble now, mate, is if people actually believe that will be happening, you know.
Exactly. Yeah. But in terms of the competition now, I mean, when I started, it was the three newspapers: the Herald, the Sun, the Age. There wasn't even a specific sort of sports show during the week on radio. Sports Today on 3RW, I think, started probably, you know, in the mid-90s, early to mid-90s. Even with live sport, you know, we were back in the day still when you were playing. It was just the replay on a Saturday night for 2 hours on Channel 7 and the winners on the ABC. To where we are now, everyone's a journo when they've got their, you know, their camera and their phone. It's a completely different world.
No, it's amazing. And just like, you know, looking back on those times, for you, Trevor, I mean, Hey Hey It's Saturday, I can remember watching it from when it was, people forget it was in the morning, it was supposed to be a kid's show, and then, of course, it was never a kid's show. It was for the kids could watch Aussie Ostrich and see this stuffed toy, but all the double meanings and the stuff behind it. For that to go, become so big, and you become such an integral part of that, how was that for you?
That was you know, fantastic, I have to say. I mean, and it's another example because Russell got the gig, when it went from being a morning show to the Saturday night version, Russell got a gig on there and they said, oh, who do you want to work with? And he said, me. So suddenly Russell and I were sitting around a room with Daryl and Ernie Carroll and Pam Barnes and just shooting the shit about what was going to be on the show. I mean, we were called creative consultants, which is like, it's like a writer that never picks up a pen.
I like that.
Well, it's not scripted, right? So, yes. So it's more of the, okay, Daryl comes in dressed as a banana. Okay, yeah, right. Away we go, right? It's purely to come up with stuff to set a platform for everyone to interact. But the thing about it was that, I'd had a few jobs in TV, like I'd directed a show, I'd produced other stuff, but I was there sort of, writing with Russell and directing his stuff, producing it, sitting on the edit, and in between, sitting around with Daryl and Ernie Carroll and Pam, as I say, and what you learn about television production, sitting in that room with people like that, yeah, is just absolute gold. I mean, Ernie Carroll speaks and you learn in a sentence something that it took him 10 years to figure out. And that was a great experience. And it also meant that when we started the footy show, it was a real, it wasn't sort of a production team laden with live entertainment expertise, it has to say. I mean, we were a very low priority and there was not much budget. And so consequently, sitting in that production room, I probably had the most experience by far of anyone in live entertainment. So I was, I was able to be a strong voice in that room and, and help, Eddie and I had talked, about what we wanted it to be. And, between the two of us, steered it in the right direction. I mean, him from his hosting point of view and me just about, what the content was and, what works and what doesn't. And it's amazing when you're sitting around production meetings, in the footy show, how things would come up very similar to that I'd encountered on Hey Hey, and you'd be able to go, Yeah, actually, no, we don't do that, and I'll tell you why.
Yeah. So, I was going to say, but one of the things, John Blackman on Hey Hate Saturday, and I know with you on the footy show, one of the things I always liked is you weren't the main character. You just held back, and when the right thing turned up, you just went in and bang, and came out with the right little bit, and then sat back. So he was the voice, but I know with the bar, you know, you behind the bar, they'd always throw to you. When you, you know, you'd sort of put a look, yeah, I've got something, and then bang, you hit you. How did you find that sort of being a main character, but not a main character, if I can say it like that?
It was good for me. I mean, I just totally flew under the radar for 15 years. I mean, it's hilarious to me, but there's been far more written about me in the papers since I finished on the show than was ever written about me when I was on it. But meanwhile, my colleagues couldn't stay out of the papers and out of the media. And no, it was very handy for me to just fly under the radar like that. But on John, I mean, I sort of hadn't really sort of thought much about it. But once I started working on the show, you know, John was actually, in his own way, though you never saw him, he was kind of the star of the show.
Yeah.
Between the phone ringing and the chipping in over the tops and just the voiceover reads and, you know, the head on the stick would come up. I mean, you know, really it was... You know, it was John's humour that was all over the show, that really drove it. I mean, Ernie was great sitting there as the ostrich with his little, you know, sort of cracks here and there that you hardly even notice, but you just make you absolutely pissed. And, John was actually massively a driver of the success of that show. As you say, you never saw him.
Yeah, it's very good. Yeah, so, and Bruce, well, for you, for that, like, in the media, you have, like you said, you want to see your name there. And of course, there's this, you know, you need to be seen because you get work if you're good at it. But for you being that sort of in that industry, you know, how much do you want to be the story and how much do you not want to be the story, so to speak?
Oh, well, it's a good point, Simon. And one of the first things we were taught in the cadetship on the Herald was that, you know, you're there to report on the news, not be the news. Now, there's been probably a blurring of the lines from probably some mutual friends of all of us over the years who've become media types, who've become very big stars. So, but that suits some of the guys, but particularly in the sports media. They've got that personality to run with that. I mean, the beauty of I've only ever been print and radio, only a very small bit of television in the boxing world. So with print and radio,
we've just lost.
Still anonymous. Name. They might know your name. They might know your voice. But you know, there's no. Yeah, you still got me there. Yeah, you're still anonymous. They know your name, but they might know your voice if you've got a distinctive voice, but you still, you just walk around the streets, no one really has any idea who you are. So, the three main, I know we're going to the digital space and that now, but the three main areas of media, that's why they're so different, but they're also alluring in terms of print and the two forms of electronic media. I mean, radio, a lot of people say with radio, it's basically been Twitter for, you know, however many years that radio's been around. The immediacy of radio is what's always really appealed to me.
Yeah, it's good. And my media career, someone said to me, I've got a face for radio and a voice for writing, and you can't write. So, you know, that's where it's gone from. Sorry, Trev, I'm trying to be funny. I should apologise. I'm ever trying to be funny in front of you. Excuse me.
It's working beautifully, mate.
So just from both of you there, because what's the hardest thing you've had to go through? Because in these, like, there's a whole lot of experience. And I was talking to somebody the other day, and they didn't realize, they had this really interesting conversation, because I was talking about how people are successful people in any field. Most of them, if not all of them, have had to come over some obstacles, had to get over some obstacles. So for you, has there been a time when you've gone, well, I don't know if I've got a job or I'm not getting where I want to go, or have you found that? Bruce, the starters.
Yeah, well, I guess the way it finished for me at SEN back in August 2007, I was one of the originals when SEN, I mean, the first day of SEN in 2004 was the day Hooksy was killed. So it was a very sad, somber way for sports radio in Melbourne to start. And again, everyone at the station knew him one way or another. So I was there for 3.5 years, and I've been hosting the evening show when I was moved on. But as I often say in the media, maybe Trevor would agree with it. I mean, you're either, you know, you've either been sacked or waiting to be sacked. Yeah. You're not trying if you haven't been sacked. So, I mean, for that probably 18 months between August 07 and February 09 when I was picked up by 3RW, that was a really tough 18 months of just freelancing. Where you know, and it's not about calling in favours and stuff like that, but it shakes your self-belief a little bit. Yeah. I was, you know, in my late 30s at the time, and you're thinking, well, where's the next, you know, serious sort of gig coming from, given I'd sort of been around for a while, but around for 20 years by then. But, so, I mean, that's been the hardest moment for me. And then there's times in your job that have been, I touched on earlier, as a 19-year-old covering the Queen Street Massacre.
Yeah.
But even go back just 6 years, our second year of covering cricket on the network was the Phil Hughes summer. I remember being sent with Dean Jones, again, who was still grieving the loss of Dino just a few months ago. Dino and I were sent by, Fairfax Radio as it was then, to, you know, to represent the company at Phil Hughes's funeral, and just sort of being fairly new in the cricket media landscape at that time. I mean, just those few weeks, they were pretty tough to cope with as well.
Yeah, no, good point. And Trevor, with you, I mean,
Before you do, Simon, I just want to say to Bruce, mate, if I ever have the opportunity to employ you somewhere, can you just do me a favour? Have the first day off and turn up on the second day, because the first day you show up joints, nothing good happens.
Yeah, I've got to work in
my space really shuttles blow up, people get massacred. Blimey. Okay, so, mate, so don't come the first day, all right?
I'll chuck a sickie.
Have the day off. You have the day off. You start on the second
beautifully,
day.
Beautifully okay. Done, Trevor. Beautifully done. Now, I was going to say, because you've been, as you said, you've been a writer in a whole lot of things. So you've been in the front of the camera or on stage, and you're also off stage, a lot of work. So has there been times where you've had to get through difficulties?
Probably. I wouldn't say difficulties, but the pivotal thing for me was that, you go back to Punter to Punter, is that, you know, when I started doing stand-up at The Last Laugh, yeah, it wasn't long before I met Slim Whittle, and I'd actually been mad on the punt with my high school mate since I was 14, and he was they'd just started Punter to Punter, and so we got talking about horse racing, and the fact that he invited me to, you know, to come and, you know, do a spot on the show 1 week really was pivotal for my career, in that, you know, I got to actually earn a weekly living as a comedian. Yeah. While I was figuring out what to do, because while I say I was pretty lucky to, you know, get the work initially, considering, you know, what I was doing, I was just basically doing some old jokes with some stuff that I'd written to link it up. But after 12 months of doing that, you know, I had a decision to make. That routine was like, it was done and dusted. And if I wanted to continue, you know, I basically, you know, had to, you know, come up with, you know, a whole new routine. I had to start again. So what I did was I threw in my day job first, and then I sat down and I wrote a routine, and that was the routine that set me on the path. That was all original material that worked, and which sort of got me, you know, going from being a first spot on the bill to, you know, second spot, the third spot to emceeing, and set me on my way. And, you know, and I was able to do it because, you know, I'd spent, you know, a couple of years not only working, but, you know, I'd always hang around and watch the other comics and, you know, and try and learn and see what audience was laughing at and seeing what people did, what sort of material, what made them laugh, and just, you know, soaking up as much information as I could so that I, you know, so I could sit down and go, right, I'm going to do it. I'm going to write the routine. And I did. I sat down in the course of a few days and I wrote 20 minutes and, you know, that was the making and the breaking, really, or stepped me on the path, because, you know, I couldn't keep doing the routine I'd started doing.
Yeah, but it's an interesting point there, mate, because a lot of people would not make that decision to say, I'm going to leave my job first. That's a big step. That's a big step.
Trev, what was the day job? I remember when I met you guys, I think Gilbo was a courier for a company on St Kilda Road, and I went to his own. But what were you doing?
In fact, Gilbo, when he was getting ready to do his first ever stand-up bit, he actually like had his routine written and stuck to the tank of his motorbike, and he'd like he'd be learning his routine as he drove around delivering stuff for the Heine Brothers.
It's great, isn't it? What happens behind the scene, you don't see it, just for how it comes together on the night. I can remember doing a lunch down at Queenscliff, and he actually emceed. Now, I'd seen him, you know, be really funny, Russell Gilbey since, but he did a whole routine with magic as well. He had the newspapers ripping, and he was the MC, and I'm sat there just amazed at this bloke, who I thought was very funny, of course, had all this other stuff as well. He had a whole, if he had gone on himself, he could have done a whole hour, but he broke it up into little bits over the whole show. And then they, the brother-in-law, Justin, and I had to turn up as the old footballers and do our little funny, you know, very, very simple blah, blah, football stuff. But to watch him in action live, it was always fascinating for me to see. That was tremendous.
It was hilarious, actually, just knowing him, because, you know, he's kind of had an obsession with, like, magic and yes. And stuff. But you have to really practice this stuff. So he would spend endless hours, like, practicing catching a cigarette off his foot in his mouth. Yeah. And then once he was good at that, practice the lit cigarette, because that's far funnier.
Especially if it goes in the wrong way.
But he had all this stuff, the catching up, cap off the foot on the head and all this, that, and you know, magic stuff that he used to do. And but the thing is, knowing him, like, he was always practicing this stuff and always trying it out on us, right?
Yeah.
It used to drive us mad. And but eventually it found its way into his act. But I remember we were in Buenos Aires.
As you normally do, that's right.
We got sent by Hey, I don't know how we pulled this off, but we got sent to Rio Carnival. And along the way, we also, like, you know, had to do some other shoots. We went to Argentina and did a shoot at Iguazu Falls, et cetera, et cetera. Anyway, we finished up in a nightclub in Buenos Aires. And I have to say, Argentina, like, we were in this nightclub. There was, like, 120 women and 30 guys. And they were, like, the 120 most beautiful women I'd ever seen in my life. Right? But of course, you know, if you don't speak Spanish, they don't want to know. They don't want to know you, right?
But the Australian accent didn't work right. That doesn't work over there.
So we're sort of minding our own business. We're, you know, a few of us there just having a drink together. I turn around and Russell's in the corner of this club in Buenos Aires, surrounded by women, like kicking a cigarette off his foot into his mouth, and like, you know, ripping up the piece of paper and doing all those things. And I went, now I see.
Yes.
So now I see the value of all this value. Time that you've wasted as a grown man practicing this shit.
Oh, that's great, mate. That's very good. Magic does wonders. Now, gentlemen, look, it's great. So I really enjoy this because you just get insights that you don't normally see in other situations. The industry you're in, Bruce, now, can you look at how it's going? I mean, sport is developing and growing, and there's more female sport, and there's more access to sport, and there's more cricket. I mean, is it going to get too big? Is it going to dilute, or how do you see it?
It's volatile. I mean, that's 3RW, for example, we're now owned by Channel 9. Channel 9 family. They took over 13 or 14 months ago. And we've actually just, from a radio perspective, we've just had our cricket coverage axed. It hasn't fitted with the program scheduling they wanted, even though there was 4 years of the deal with Cricket Australia still to go. So a bit quieter this summer. It's ironic, actually, given the fraught nature of the Cricket Australia Channel 7 relationship at the moment, and where, you know, 9, who knows, over the next couple of years may come back into covering cricket from a TV perspective. So it's certainly this year has shown, like for example, with calling the footy on 3RW this year, at first we were doing the games at the Melbourne venues, or, you know, Marvel, MCG and Cadinia Park, from the grounds at the empty stadia. No travel interstate, of course. But then when the season resumed, we called the rest of the season just from the studio at 3RW.
From the off the TV, yeah.
Off the TV, and just had the one big monitor. So I think the TV guys were doing it with multiple monitors with down the ground footage and yes. the like. So when the director decided to go with the funky far away shot, and you're trying to guess who the little bloke, you know, that tall on the far wing was when you're calling it for radio, that made it interesting. But it took something away from it as well, in terms of there's something about calling live sport at a venue with a live crowd in the atmosphere. But that was just the world we've been living in this year. Yes. So it's a moving, fluid beast covering live sport at the moment, that's for sure.
I worry about, Bruce, is that, you know, my son's 18 and he loves his sport, but him and the kids their age, they don't pay for a single thing, right? No. They want to watch NBA, they can find us somewhere on the internet. Right, yeah. Like I pay my Foxtel subscriptions every month, you know. And that's the revenue stream that goes back into sport and keeping it afloat. But the younger generation, like if they want to watch UFC, if it doesn't matter what they want to watch, they can find it somewhere and they don't pay for it, and they never pay for it.
Go from A to B to C. You get this link to this link to this link to find it. I can't do it, but I know people who can.
Well, exactly. Pirate. And, you know, sometimes they'll be watching something that gets taken down halfway through, but then they'll just find something else.
Yeah, it's amazing. There's people out there working on that. Always remember, just about live coverage, I always remember seeing footage of years ago of the cricket coverage done from England, but in Australia, and they were listening, and they were... they actually weren't listening. They were actually getting telegrams and feeds, and they were making up the conversation, and they had a little pencil and a wood to make the bang, to make the bat noise. The bat
that was the cover drive.
The cover drive. And just maybe it's going to be a little bit more of that.
Yeah. Well, I was only thinking before, the first game of footy I ever called was the Madden Marmalade Cup. It was Essendon North Melbourne. I was blessed. The first few games I called the record comeback, when North led by 69 points 10 minutes into the second quarter. Back in Trev might be about to curl up into the fetal position here. And
I never thought we were safe, to be honest. We were 69 points in front. I still didn't think we were safe.
No, but it's really interesting because we haven't touched on your sport, even though we're talking sport there. I was actually ruck coach for North Melbourne, and I was sitting in the box that game. And there's nothing that Essendon could do in the first half went right. And then Dennis is a great coach. He got all these ideas, and nothing that happened in the second half went right for North Melbourne. It's one of those, you know, they talk about momentum. Well, that was a great, you know, the game of two halves. That was a game where you actually saw one team with all the momentum in one half, and then that absolutely changed completely to the other. And nothing would work. And that's really the mental side of the game too. It may be tactical, but all of a sudden, everybody believes in the first half and the other side doesn't. And the second half, it's the other way around. We believe we can do it, and the other went, oh, hang on. And as soon as you go, oh, hang on, it's gone. You know, it was amazing.
What about the scores that day as well? The youngsters these days, they would just shake 27 goals to 25.
Oh, you're exactly right. I mean, like
that's just about 4 weeks worth of footy these days.
Now, you see, you know, they had players who kicked 100 goals. Now, for the season, now we have teams who kick 100 goals for the season. You know, that's where it's changed. Like I was going to say, now, Trevor, I know you're the great, you have been the passionate North Melbourne supporter. So while we're doing... I know, Bruce, I don't know if you've got one. You're supposed to be unbiased, but there must be one footy side that you grew up on.
Oh, well, I'm actually a life member of the St Kilda Footy Club, which...
I knew that. Yeah. I just wanted you to say that.
Yeah, which some would say it's a life sentence.
Yeah, your suffering's the greatest, Bruce. It really is.
Probably, I MC, about 80% of their functions, 80 to 90% of their functions, and it is, it was Dad's fault. The deal was made. Mum was Melbourne, Dad was St Kilda. So any boys they had be the Saints after Dad, and any girls, I've got two older sisters, Melbourne after Mum. And so it's been a lifetime. I mean, I love the club, you know, almost as much as I love my own kids. But and they're all St Kilda as well. They're not getting out of it just because of the pain and misery that I've had. So all three kids are saints as well. But it's
that's an old story, mate. You can borrow, for any team you like. But if you want to live in this house,
correct. Yeah.
Now, I've got to say that I'm now, Trevor, just a little bit. You've obviously done a lot, been a lot involved with North Melbourne. Are you as involved as North Melbourne as much as you used to be, like doing functions, or you just watch, or how's your connection with the? It's been a very hard year to connect with any club.
I sort of hosted most of the functions there during the 90s, and it was a great thing to do in some respects. On the other hand, I kind of did it for a number of years, and I got sick of, like, you know, going to the footy at midday wearing a suit and tie, and, you know, driving there thinking, what the hell am I going to say to the crowd? And at the time, Francis Traynor, who was head of North Marketing at the time, he finished up early 2000s. And I went, okay, yeah, if you're finishing up, then I'll finish up too. Time for a change of the guard. And, yeah, because I was just looking forward to turning up at 2:05 and, yeah, you know, buying a bratwurst dog outside the MCG and feeling tomato sauce run down my skin rather than having to do a gig and sit there and eat rubber chicken.
Yeah. Beautiful. Now we're going to run, any of time, but I'll put it on a certain time because I think we get a lot of stuff done in a certain time, and we don't want to go any longer because, you know, the young people out there, if there's any listening or watching, they sort of drift off after. So if there was,
I thought we were just warming up.
Yeah, I know. Well, we can always have version two. Don't worry. We can always have version two. I always ask this, if someone now, talking about young people, going into your industry, is there one thing, one little bit of advice that you could give them, Bruce, first, that you'd say, if you're going to go, because you started as the apprentice, you know, that type of thing.
Yeah.
What would you say to them? One thing that could be good for them?
Persistence. Yeah. Just persistence, and take absolutely any offer or opportunity to get a foot in the door. And the angle I always use, one of the best sports photographers we've now got in the country, Michael Klein for the Herald Sun. He started 2 weeks after me on the Herald back in early 86. He was a messenger, just a messenger for 2 or 3 years before he got a spot in the dark room. And for those watching this today, the dark room, pre-digital photography. And he's the perfect example of someone who just stuck at it, wanted to get an opportunity to be a snapper. So, it's persistence, and just take any opportunity anywhere to get in any type of door at a media organisation, and then it's not half the battle, but that'll at least, you know, get you in front of the right people.
And Trevor, there's a whole lot of people out there who think they're funny and they're never going to be funny. But what's one thing, like, I can remember seeing a young fella get up on the stage once in a comedy, a short-lived comedy place, and I watched him die on stage. Like, literally, he picked the wrong crowd, the wrong jokes. And he finished, because he finished, and it was a polite crowd, and I sort of, and he, as he walked off, he went to himself, you know, like, and I said, what a great learning experience, as long as it didn't burn him, you know. So a lot of people don't think they're funny, but as I said, for you, one thing to the young comedian or the young wannabe comedian.
Oh, I think what I said before, Simon, in that, you know, you have something unique. In that it's you, it's your voice, your perspective, your story, your background, you know, your history. And, you know, that's what you draw on, because, you know, what a comedian needs to do is find their persona on stage, or bring their persona to the stage in a way that works for them. And, you know, you've got to find what works for you. And Russell Gilbert is, like, you know, is a great example in that, you know, Russell, like, broke all of the rules, right? Absolutely broke all of the rules, but what he did worked for him. And and that is the key, you know? And you just got to find yourself.
That's fantastic. Gentlemen, look, it's been an absolute pleasure as always. Trevor, the great, I think we can get to stage now, the great Trevor Marmalade, you can say that. And I'll say the very good Bruce Eaver. I think it's just a little...
I'm happy to cop that.
Thank you very much for your time.
Just Lovely. Before we finish, I've got a confession to make, and it's I never use it on microphone, but if anyone ever asks me, you know, got a quick gag or something like that, I always say, you know, Trevor Marmalade. I said, you know, that's not his real name. I said, really? I said, yeah, it's Roger Marmalade.
boom, boom.
And they still laugh. I just, so confess, sorry, Trev, I've used that line for years. And it's,
but if you, yeah, like the Ulster, mate, don't get any new material, just get a new audience. That's always the one.
Yeah, no, it's I used to do that joke. I mean, yeah, it's not my real name. My real name's Peter Marmalade. I changed it for tax reasons.
Beautiful, well, what a beautiful one to finish on. Gentlemen, Trevor Marmalade, Bruce Eber, thank you very much for your insight. Thank you very much for your time and good luck for, well, let's say good luck for 2021 because we've got to look forward. Good on you. Thank you.
Thanks for having us, Simon. Good to see you, Bruce.
Good to see you, Trev.
Okay.